Hi, everybody. My name is Larsine. I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. And I want to thank you very, very much for the opportunity to get to be here. And I want to thank Dick and Barbara for inviting me to come, and my husband being able to make this trip with me as well. It's a real honor and a privilege. And all the people that have spoken before, very good friends and people that I love very much and respect very much, even though they're very, very sick. And and remind me why I keep coming to Al-Anon on a daily basis. It's something. And I'm going to be really honest with you guys. I am really very intimidated to be here with them, going through the steps. You know, being charged with doing 8 and 9 is a huge honor for me, an absolutely huge honor for me. I have so much gratitude to Alcoholics Anonymous. I cannot even begin to tell you. I mean, I'm an Al-Anon, but I have so much love and revere deeply the principles and steps and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that they so generously have shared with the family members. I can't even tell you how grateful I am for that. And I have a lot of reverence for AA, too, because I've been so well-loved by Alcoholics Anonymous. I was well-loved by AA before I ever set foot in Al-Anon. You know, I would go with my husband when he first got sober to AA meetings because I needed to make sure he heard what he was supposed to be hearing. And because he's not very quick, okay? And he doesn't pick up on things. And I remember going with him in the beginning, and I used to be really fearful about going to AA meetings with Butch because I was panicked that they would think I was alcoholic. I don't know why that freaked me out, but it always did. So I would say to Butch, I go, well, how are they not going to know that I'm not an alcoholic? And he said, don't worry, they'll know, okay? I always thought that was a compliment, but apparently not. And now the longer I'm in Al-Anon, the irony is they think I should be in AA, you know? So, so they're always telling me they're saving me a seat, but I can't get past that half a drink thing yet, so I'm not quite getting there. But, you know, I want you to know that, you know, I've been to probably hundreds, if not thousands, of AA speaker meetings, and my program has definitely been enhanced by going to open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am so grateful for the things I have learned in AA that I can turn, that you show, and how you share shows me how I can apply that to my life. And my program is definitely so enhanced by that, without a doubt. But I am not going to stand before you today and pretend that I know what it's like to be an alcoholic, or that I know what you're feeling or what you're going through or any of that. I'm going to share about steps 8 and 9. I'm going to share them from the Al-Anon perspective because that's my experience. That's the only way I can share that with you. Though my ability to do 8 and 9 has been greatly enhanced by hearing people in Alcoholics Anonymous talk about, you know, their experience with it. And I'm a big reader of the big book. You know, in Al-Anon, we have a lot of literature. We have a lot of good literature. I really believe that we do. But sometimes we have so much literature, it gets a little bit confusing about how to do it. And people come in with all kinds of writing your life story, you know, when you're doing your fourth and fifth. And we have a blueprint for progress, and people use that. And, you know, but to me, what I believe, and I believe it because I believe that Lois believed it, is that she did the 12 steps through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous because that's what was available to her. And what I like about doing the 12 steps as an Al-Anon through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is that there's a real definition of how to do things. You know, I mean, it's just like you do this, and then you do this, and then you do this. In Al-Anon, we pause a lot. And sometimes it's a good thing, but a lot of times it's a bad thing. And I've gotten much, much benefit out of the Al-Anon literature on the steps and equally from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. When my husband first got sober, he couldn't wait for me to read the big book, boy. He was all over me. He got sober and in a hospital program in 1979, and they didn't do no family recovery back then, boy. It was just all about the alcoholic and kissing their butt when they got sober and stuff. And did not go over well with me at all. And because, you know, it's really hard when, you know, they are the scum of the earth, buttheads of the universe, and then they get sober, and it's sainthood status. I mean, it's just insane how fast that flitches, you know. I mean, they do the most ordinary things to standing frigging ovations, you know. They get a legitimate driver's license. Whoa, you know. What the heck? That's always is like, you know, I got insurance, oh yeah, you know. Like, you know how long I've been doing that? For years, and no one has ever once patted me on the back for that, you know, never one time. So anyway, but he couldn't wait for me to read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I read it, and I tell you, after I read it, I knew it was written by an alcoholic, no doubt about that, you know. Especially when you read, you know, The Family afterwards, the chapter to the wives, my personal favorite. Holy moly. And I don't blame Lois for being pissed at Bill for not letting her write that one. You know, but the one thing I did remember when I read that was I did read the steps, and I couldn't wait for my husband to get to step 9. Okay, I'm telling you, I was all, oh, I just could not wait for that to happen. And, you know, and when we went through that process, he went through that process, you know, and he sat down with me, you know, I was ready. Boy, I just wanted to make, you know, when he said he wanted to make his amends to me, boy, I want to make, the kids are in bed, get myself a Coke, get my cigarettes, because I was smoking then, the good old days, and, you know, we were, and I was just ready for the big, everything he ever did to me, you know, and in actuality, he did his, you know, 9th step with me in probably 60 seconds or less. And I was devastated by that, absolutely devastated. You know, I picked up the book again because I'm sure he missed stuff, you know, that he was supposed to be doing. But, you know, again, lack of knowledge is our dilemma. And, you know, and I also am grateful in being in Al-Anon how important the steps are to the family members as well. You know, I really believe with all my heart and soul about family recovery, and I don't know how you get well without doing the 12 steps. I don't know. And I know that from my own personal experience, because my experience was, at least what I believed, is that when Butch got sober, that would fix me. Because I really believe the problem was his drinking. And once he stopped doing that, all of our problems would go away and our life would be good as it was meant to be. You know, and no one was more shocked when my husband was almost 2 years sober and I was as mad as I have ever been in my life, as I have ever been. And no one was more shocked than me that his sobriety did not fix me. I was blown absolutely away from that. And the fact that that hadn't fixed me is really the driving force that got me to come to Al-Anon. Because then I knew it just wasn't about him anymore, it was about me. Because there was no way I could no longer rationalize how I could justify my bad behavior, you know, when he was doing all the things that I knew would fix me. When he was a sober member, a good sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, working a good program, going to work, making a living, taking care of his family, being a good husband, being a good father, all those things I thought would fix me, and none of them did, because the problem didn't lie with him anymore. It was how I was affected by the family disease of alcoholism. And Lois, too, you know, because I've read a lot about, you know, Lois and, you know, in the beginning, I got really curious about all that. How was she able to do that? I know how important she was to Alcoholics Anonymous and her place in it. And I always think Alcoholics Anonymous should always be so grateful to her. What a loving woman. What an absolutely loving woman. And I had the great, great opportunity to get to hear Lois speak down in Palm Springs when I was just but a couple years in the program. And I also have my ODAT, which my sponsor had me have her autograph. And that's very special to me. Now, at the time, my sponsor wanted me to get her to autograph it. I didn't think, who the heck is she? You know, just another person. You know, I had absolutely no idea. But I remember hearing her talk that time and her talking about the steps and, you know, and how her feeling about how the family is affected is that she didn't think any words in the steps needed to be changed at all. Not even the word, I am powerless over alcohol, did she feel need to be changed. The only thought that, you know, only thing that she thought needed to be changed was that we change, carry this message to others. Because we ended up in Al-Anon because we were trying to carry the message to alcoholics. That's why we end up here in the first place. So she didn't want us to do that no more. I know people always talk about intervention. I'm like, we had it every night at my house, okay? Every night was intervention night at my house. So, But so anyway, so the steps are hugely important to me, and as is the Al-Anon literature. And like I say, in using the book and going back and forth, and I've been taken through the steps by people I love and trust, and who have guided me through them very lovingly, even though I have fought them every step of the way. Every step of the way. Because, you know, again, my head, my belief, it's not my fault. It's not my fault. I don't have to do these things. You know, he has to do these things, not me. And then, in, you know, working the steps, and what I like about, you know, in the big book, you know, when you start steps 8 and 9, it says, now we need more action, without which we find that faith without works is dead. And faith without works, you know, and again, some of the wording in these books always kind of throws me for a loop. But what is faith without works? You know, it's just that. I think Sheldon talked about it, you know, so well, as has everybody else that's spoken. It's, you know, I mean, it's one thing to believe, it's one thing to, you know, but to actually take the action when every sense tells you not to do that, that you might be embarrassed, you might not look good. You know, it's just the fear behind all of that. And I am so grateful that I have been shown how to take the action by my sponsors. And I've just had two sponsors. My first sponsor, Jeannie, I had the first 9 years I was in the program. She took me through the steps, and she died when I was 9 years in Al-Anon. And boy, having a sponsor die is one sucky deal, let me tell you. And especially when you're as sick as I am. You know, to have her, I mean, talk about feeling abandoned and left alone. And again, how sick I am, you know, that I would have this wonderful woman die on me and it would still be all about me. You know, and I think that I'm the good guy and always on all the situations, that I'm not, you know, the alcoholics are the self-centered ones. You know, but in reality, that was that. She was kind of leaving me. I didn't know what to do. But when I think about taking more action, you know, and the scariness of that, when I was maybe, I don't know, 10 years in the program or something, we were getting together. We were going to do a fundraiser for Alateen, and so we were over at this lady's house, another Al-Anon, and figuring out, you know, how we could actually raise money for Alateen and not just raise $7. You know, it was like, you know, what can we really do to bring the AAs and the Al-Anons all in? Because we were doing a fundraiser for Alateen so that they could go to their SCAC conference, which is the Southern California Alateen Conference. We get buses and get registrations for them because they're kids. And Alateen is part of Al-Anon, and they need our support. And so we were going to do this big fundraiser. And while we're over there doing this fundraiser, it turns out that there's like 7 of us there that are on the planning committee, and 3 of us don't know how to swim, literally swim. And the ladies whose house we're at, her daughter has just taken a job as a swim instructor at the Lucky Duck Swim School. Now we're supposed to be doing this fundraiser, but the next thing I know, the 3 of us are signed up for swimming lessons because they've taken a group conscience that we should learn how to swim at the Lucky Duck Swim School. Now, at this point, I'm like 32 or something, and the other lady's 35, and the other lady's 45. And so they sign us up, and we go down there to the Lucky Duck Swim School and to have our first lesson, but we don't know that... Now, there's a lot of little kids there getting swimming lessons with us. We are the biggest people there, and we're the only one that has a person with a tattoo in our group as well. And and we weren't bugged by the little kids, but we were freaked out by all the parents that were there, you know, because it was just whatever. And my sponsor was there, and, you know, she's up there, and she says, yeah, people are going, which one's yours? And she goes, the one with the tattoo, you know. Like, and when we were learning how to swim, man, we were afraid. Every time they'd send us in the pool, we'd mow over little kids, you know, whatever. Just get out of the way. We're going to the other end. But I tell you, the day came one time when they wanted me to jump into the deep end. And I am terrified of water. I am absolutely terrified of water. And I'm terrified of water because when I was a little kid, my mom wanted my dad to teach me and my sister how to swim. And we were little kids, 4, 3 years old. My sister's just a year old. 15 months younger than me, and so my dad's idea of teaching us how to swim was to take us out in the lake and throw us in, and so I'm afraid of water, and because that didn't work too well, and so and that fear, like anything else in this program, just grows and grows and gets so big, you know, it was just monumental for me, and so the day came when I had to jump into the deep end. And I can't tell you all the fear that I was overcome with. But I went to the end and I said my prayers and I jumped in because they said exactly what would happen would happen. I booped right back up to the top again. And then my 18-year-old instructor was there, you know, to grab my arm when I came up that time. I didn't have to go on a second time or a third time as I had done when I'd gotten thrown in the water in the lake. You know, and that was just taking an action against every fear that I had. And yet I'd trust an 18-year-old instructor, and yet every day, as Sheldon said, I can't turn my will and my life over to the care of God because of fear about what he's going to do or if he's going to punish me or do whatever. You know, so I am real appreciative of the into action portion of this program. I think it's such an important thing that no matter how fearful you are, that you know that you have a sponsor that's going to grab you when you come up that second time. You can count on it. You can count on it. And so, when I want to, you know, the book says, you know, it's really short in the AA book about it. We got a lot more literature in Al-Anon about it, but, you know, the making the list part. The book is very, you know, you've done your fourth and fifth step. That's where you get the list from. I personally, when I did my fourth and fifth, didn't think I owed amends to anybody. That's a big Al-Anon trait, okay? Sorry, you know. We know you guys, we know who should be on your list, okay? The alcoholics, oh man, they got a list, you know, but us, you're a victim. You are a victim, and I certainly was, and I could justify and do everything. You know, like when I was doing my four-step with my sponsor, I'd written a life story thing, but she made me put in a four-column deal, okay? She just, as I was going through it, we did the four-column thing. Well, we did the three-column thing. And then when I get to the fourth column, and then I'm supposed to say my part in it always went like this. Well, Dick did this to me, so I did that to him. And everything, I couldn't even not think that way. No matter how much she tried to turn me around to what my part was, I could never see it. I am so hardwired to be the guy you feel sorry for. And why? Because I grew up in an alcoholic home. You know, I grew up with that. And that makes me an automatic victim. That automatic gives me, you know, that self-righteous justification, you know, for every bad behavior I've ever had in my life. You know, and I grew up with a dad as an alcoholic. You know, I had no idea my dad was an alcoholic. How are you supposed to know such things? You know, you just grow up and this is your dad, you know. And my dad drank beer every single solitary day. My dad got drunk every day. That's just what my dad did. And my dad, unfortunately, when he drinks, is a mean drunk. He just is. I don't know why that happens to some people and other people are happy-go-lucky or at least don't hurt people. But my dad is a mean person when he's drinking. Not fun to be around. My first emotion as a child that I can remember, my very first feeling is being afraid of my father. The very first thing I remember in my life is being afraid of my dad. And he was just, and I don't know, he just... I used to wonder when I was a little kid why someone would go to all the trouble to marry someone just to make them feel like a piece of crap, you know, and to make the kids feel crappy. And my dad hated having girl children. You know, that was his thing, too, when he threw us in the lake. It was like if we were boys, we would have learned how to swim right away, but we were girls and therefore just proved one more time. And when you start learning those lessons as a little kid growing up, you know, talk about low self-esteem or whatever. But what I've learned today in going to open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and lots of meetings of Al-Anon is that I just got a lot of misinformation from a man who had a lot of misinformation. You know, and I've learned how to place that now. I am so grateful for that. But I was so angry at my dad. I was so angry at my dad when I got to Al-Anon, I can't even tell you. You know, and I heard my dad ended up dying when he was 55 years old. He died the death that they talk about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, total insanity and death. I can't even tell you the last words my father said to me. They were so vile and so vulgar, I wouldn't even begin to repeat them from this podium. And I always say the last words my father said, and in reality, I know those are the last words my father's alcoholism said to me. Because when my dad died, believe you me, that's all that was laying there. That was just the ugly disease of alcoholism in all its hideous, hurtful, spiteful death. That's just all that was there. And anyway, I did a lot of work when I was in the program. My dad died when he was 55 years old, and I had just started coming to Al-Anon. My dad died in 1981, and I started coming to Al-Anon in June of 81. He died in October of 81. So June to October, I wasn't even close to loving and kind or forgiving or nothing. You know, I was still into I hate you, and I don't even know why I'm here. But I did a lot of work. I did so much step work on my dad, I can't even tell you. So much writing with my sponsor. But it didn't seem to matter how much work I did. Boy, every time I would think about the things my dad had done to me or said to me, I would just get so angry all over again. And I don't know how you are, but when I'm really angry and pissy and just really suffering, I love to take it home and share it with my family and my children and the people that I love and care about the most, because that's the family disease of alcoholism for me. And so I remember one time talking to my sponsor about it after a particularly bad episode at home where I was a very mean, angry mom, not proud about it whatsoever, but coming to Al-Anon for a few years and still not being able to turn all that off. You know, because I grew up being hit and yelled at and screamed at. That's how I know how to parent. And I remember talking with her about it, and I remember her telling me, you know, Larsine, because again, one more time, sponsors have such a way of saying things. You know, she said, you did everything we've asked you to do in Al-Anon, all the writing, all the step work, it's all been good. She goes, but now we need to work on an absolute solution for you, because Al-Anon isn't about the problem. We know what the problem is. Al-Anon's about a solution. You know, so she said, I'm going to give you an assignment. You're not going to like it. And I never liked an assignment I've ever gotten in Al-Anon, because it always seems so trivial to the very, very major problems I have going on in my life. And what she told me that I had to do, she says, I want you to go home and I want you to think about a good thing your dad has done for you. And my initial reaction to that is that there's no such good thing. I mean, you know, it's just, that's the, you know, and that's how the family disease of alcoholism wants you to think, that nothing good has ever happens, ever goes on. It just keeps you in that negativity and that bad thinking all the time. But you know, one thing I've learned right out of the gate since I first came into Al-Anon, and I am so grateful, and I really do consider it God's grace, is that I heard right out of the gate that you have to be willing. And if you're not willing to do anything different, how can you possibly expect anything to be different? And so I've always been willing. I've only been this much willing, but I've always had some willingness. And believe you me, I believe this program is so powerful that you only need this much willingness to be able to carry it off. You know, that's just how powerful this program is. And I don't know how long it took, a week or two, and I came up with the fact that my dad had taught me how to drive. And if you're going to live in Southern California and marry an alcoholic of your own and track that sucker down, boy, you need that skill, okay? You just need to know how to do that. And so I remember going to my sponsor and thinking she would not be happy with the answer, you know, because it just didn't seem like it was much, but that was really all that I had. You know, my first sponsor, Jeannie, she's a clapper, you know, she's like one of these people, you know, always like that. You know, whenever I would do anything, yes, I see. And so I had told her about, I said, well, I came up with a good thing my dad had done. Yes. And when I told her, I thought I was, no, not going to be good. But no, now she starts jumping up and down, because that's just, you know, because I have completed an assignment, which to her is a miracle in itself. And she says, now, Larsine, whenever you think about the stuff your dad said to you or did to you, or how he made you feel bad about being a girl, or when he hit you or yelled at you or whatever it was that makes you so uncomfortable today, I just want you to take that negative emotion and replace it with this positive one. You know, and it wasn't too long after that that I thought up a second thing my dad had done and a third thing that my dad had done. Because the family disease of alcoholism doesn't ever want you to think that there's anything that's good that's going on. And in reality, what I know, and again from going to so many open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and hearing alcoholics talk about how they treated their family and the things that happened, you know, I know that it was my dad, you know, and how he was affected by the disease of alcoholism. That I believe with all my heart he loved us as much as his disease would allow him to, until he got sicker and sicker and sicker until there was nothing of that person left. And I don't mean I grew up to tell you this story and tell you I grew up in this hellacious family and that, you know, my sponsor gave me this assignment, you know, and blew rainbows and butterflies up my butt, you know, and then it made it all better. That is not what happened. What my sponsor gave me is she gave me a very precious gift. She gave me the gift of forgiveness. And forgiveness is no favor. We do it for nobody but ourselves. It says so in our literature. And to me, forgiveness is a huge, huge part of steps 8 and 9, especially from an Al-Anon perspective. It's coming from that family person, you know, that person who thinks they've been so subjected to so much, you know, cruelty and meanness. And the idea of when I was doing my, you know, my steps, that I had to put my dad on my amends step was just, you have got to be kidding me. You know, the forgiveness part I could see. You know, I could see that part of it, but I could not see me having to make amends to him. No way, because if I had to make amends to him, then that meant I was letting him off the hook. And I was not going to do that, because I was the little kid, and he was the dad. When is that fair? Show me in the literature how that works out. That's not right. He was supposed to make me feel special. I was supposed to be like a princess thing and stuff. I was anything but that with my dad. But I remember my sponsor saying to me, you know what, your dad died with all of his children being glad he was dead. You know, do you need to punish anybody more than that? You think that was his goal? You're a parent. You know, do you need to punish anybody more than that? You know, and because of that, I was able to put my dad on the amends list. And I was able to put my dad on my amends list, not because of the things, you know, because, I mean, as a little kid, what did I do to my dad? I didn't do anything to my dad. I never did anything. I was just afraid of him. Spent my whole life doing nothing but being afraid of him, you know. But when I was an adult, and I remember when my dad was in the hospital and he was dying, and he was, I remember one time, maybe just 2 days before he died, he said to me, why can't you come over here and hold my hand? And I couldn't do it. Couldn't do it. And I always say I couldn't do it, but what I know today is I wouldn't do it. And I wouldn't do it because I wanted to hurt him. I really did. A dying person. And I'm not the alcoholic here, but he's hurt me so much. All I know is I want to hurt him back. I want you to feel fear. Yeah, die, old man. Tell me how that's going down for you now. And where does all that hatred come from? From the innocent girl here. I'm the victim. Because I'm affected by the family disease of alcoholism. And I am not proud of that. You know, and I like in the book, too, where it talks about those things that, you know, what about those amends that you can't make anymore because there's no living person to make them to? Those things that you cannot make right. You know, and in the book it says, you know, I thought I had it underlined, but it doesn't matter. I'm not going to quote the book word for word or whatever. But, you know, but it talks about, you know, the fact that I would willingly do something different. You know, that today if I could make it different, I would do it differently. You know, but I didn't have the program or the stuff to be able to do that differently. And that's a hard thing for me. And I think about my dad every single solitary day. You know, and for many, many years, I haven't had a photo of my dad in my house. And basically, I haven't because I didn't have one without him holding a can of beer in his hand. You know, so I didn't want that. I didn't want that picture of him ever. And then it just happens that just this past Saturday, I was at my mom's house, and my brother has died. He had a brain tumor a while back, and we were going through some of his stuff, posters and things he had. My mom wanted to go through these boxes we had packed up after he passed away, and he's been gone for a little while, so we were going through them. And I found two pictures in there of my dad without beer, just pictures of my dad, smiling even. You know, and I took them home with me, and I still haven't put them up or anything. Right now I got them face down in my closet, and because I'm working on it. It's a process. And I have to tell you, too, when my dad died, you know, my dad was a decorated World War II veteran and a Korean War veteran, and he was a very good soldier, and he had a very distinguished career in the Army, and when he died, he was cremated, because my mom had divorced him, they brought his ashes to me, the military did, his medals, the flag, all of that was delivered to me, and I was by myself that day when they gave me those things, and I remember they left, and here I am with my dad in his ashes, his medal, the flag. So I take his ashes, and I go downstairs to my laundry room, and I put him behind the washing machine, and I said, and you sit here, and you think about what you did. And he sat there for a very long time, I'm here to tell you. Every so often, I would go down there even and go, okay, Sarge, who's in charge now? Sarge, you got something to say to me now, Sarge? Want to learn how to swim? And every once in a while, I just pick up that box and just shake the crap out of it, you know, and then set it back down, you know. Totally with sponsor permission, for sure. Because that's the deal, you know, that's the deal. But anyway, getting into making the amends list, you know, so what I ended up doing was when I went through and I was doing my amends and putting those people on the list, you know, my sponsor had to tell me who had to go on the list. And some things are obvious. My kids, without a doubt. Even as the mom of, you know, and stuff. I mean, it's like, I'd like to tell you that as a mom, I really believed I was protecting always my children from the alcoholic, when in reality, they never needed protection from their dad. You know, when my husband was drinking, that's what he was doing, and doing drugs and all that other kind of stuff, but he was never, ever abusive to those kids. I was the one who was abusive to those kids. I, the sober parent. Because this is where the family disease of alcoholism took me. We had a thing one day when Butch was going to have a family reunion, and it was his family. He's one of 9 kids, you know, so it's a big deal. And he's the only alcoholic out of the bunch. Lucky, lucky me. And, you know, and guess the day, you know, and this family reunion's coming up, and I make him raise his right hand and promise me that he will, you know, stay sober that day. And he does, because he means to. I know he wants to. But the day comes, and guess who's so drunk and so loaded he can't even stand up. And I am so angry at him, so angry at him. And I'm here to tell you, no matter how drunk or loaded my husband has been, he's never, ever raised a hand to hit me. The complete opposite of my dad. They are alcoholic, and that's the only thing about them that is the same. But I remember poking him in the chest and egging him to hit me. Let's just take it to the next level. And I became very conscious of our 2 little boys at that point who were like, again, 4 and 3 years old, and they were standing on either side of me, and they're yanking at my pant leg, and they're begging me, Mommy, Mommy, please stop yelling at Daddy. And I would like to tell you that I had a moment of clarity then, but I absolutely did not. What I started doing was I started screaming at those little boys, how dare they tell me to stop yelling at their dad when he's the reason our life is the piece of crap that it is. And by the time I got done yelling at these little boys, I watched my drunken husband walking out the front door, and I, the sober mother, say to the drunken dad, where do you think you're going? And the drunken dad turns to the sober mom and says, I'm leaving because we're upsetting the kids. And again, I don't tell you this story because I'm proud of it. I tell you the story because this is where the family disease of alcoholism took me. And I think I'm the good guy, and nobody needs to be on my list of amends. Because I'm the one that's been holding it all together. I'm the one with the job. I'm the one, I'm the one, I'm the one. You know, in reality, I'm so blinded to how I've been affected by it. Totally blinded by it. Even in doing my 4th and 5th step with my sponsor. Painful for me. Just painful for me. And like I say, so she's the one that helped me fill out the list. Now, I had no trouble putting both my boys on that list. Absolutely, positively not. I had a struggle putting my husband on the list. Big struggle with that one. You know, because one more time, not my fault. This wasn't supposed to be this way. This guy hurt me time and time again. And then he would tell me that he loved me. And then he would hurt me again. He broke my trust. He broke my heart over and over. And when it talks in our literature about watching someone you love slowly kill themselves with alcohol. And I don't share this because this is really the reality anymore. It was my reality, though. Because when you feel sorry for yourself, there's no going back on that train. Okay, you're on that train. And once you start chugging up and you're picking up the speed, and that's what a sponsor and steps are for. I've been on the wrong track for a long time. A long, long time. Because like I said, he never meant to do it. But see, I don't understand about alcoholism. I don't. And why? Because if I have a drink, I can take a drink or not take a drink. And if I can take a drink or not take a drink, that means you can take a drink or not take a drink. I call that information from nowhere because I don't ask nobody nothing. I just think this crap up all the time. Lands in my head, becomes fact for me. You know, because as long as I can make it look so I look good in the picture, boy, that's how the scenario's coming down. You know, so therefore he's drinking at me. He means to hurt me. You know, and I'm here to tell you, I have heard, as I said, hundreds, if not thousands, of alcoholics speak, and I have yet to hear one of them share ever that they drank to hurt their wife or their kids or their mom or their dad, that was ever their purpose for picking up the drink. I have never, ever heard that. But I believe that with every fiber of my being. And so it was very difficult for me to put my husband on the list. But again, one more time, willingness is the key here. My sponsor said, we're just going to make the list, and then you're going to become willing, because that's what happens in the process of the steps. It's not about I'm going to jump all on board. It's just that I'm going to become willing. And how long of a process that's going to be is going to depend on how long I want to suffer through it. And I can suffer. I'm good at it. It's too bad you don't get a degree in that kind of stuff, because I would be well educated. And I always tell people, you know, coming in here moaning and complaining, being a martyr, you know, suffering, being angry, you don't get any credit for that whatsoever. We all know how to do that real well when we come into these rooms, without a doubt. And so I became willing, you know, and then my dad on the list, my mom on the list, hard to put my mom on the list as well. You know, she's a grown woman. Why are you staying with this guy? Why are you putting us kids through this? You know, and again, going to open meetings of Al-Anon, I got to hear women share in the 50s and the 60s, you know, when they had to work. I mean, they couldn't get jobs. My mom didn't even drive. She didn't even have a driver's license. I mean, those things just weren't available to her. You know, she had to stick out. She didn't know where else. Where are you going to go with four kids? What's going to happen to you if you don't stick it out? And, you know, and then, and, you know, and so I got to understand that about it. But I was didn't want to put my mother on the list either. No way. She should have taken care of us kids. She should have left my dad. You know, and then as far as it goes, and like Sheldon said, and I agree with that 100%, then it got to be everybody I've ever known in my life. I hated people who had regular lives. I hated my neighbors just because their husband came home every night for dinner. I hated the people I worked with because they went on vacations. I hated them because they had a good life. How I am affected by the disease of alcoholism, and I'm not the person that's drinking. And I put to you, sometimes that's why it's hard to do these steps as an Al-Anon person, because I think I'm the good guy in the situation. And my hatred isn't fueled by alcohol or drugs. It's just fueled by my anger at you because you're not doing things the way that I want you to do them, the way that I think that will make me happy. And so, you know, and again, you know, so anyway, my sponsor helped me make the list. We put a lot of people on this. And again, she took this off my fourth and fifth. And again, where I didn't feel where it was or whatever. No, my kids were the first people I went after. And they were fairly small at the time. I remember going home. I remember making them raise their right hand because alcoholism in my father, alcoholism in their father. You know, you have to promise me you'll never be an alcoholic or a drug addict. We're going to nail this one right in the kisser here, boy. And of course, they were little dudes. They did, you know, and stuff. And, you know, and mommy's going to try and do better. And daddy's obviously doing better, you know. And this is, you know, and I think I'm on the path and everything's going to be wonderful. But, you know, again, if you don't go through the process and you don't take the action, nothing changes. It doesn't change. And so, so I'm getting these people on the list. And I have made amends to my sons so often. They are now 40 years and 37 years old. If I even start to even act like I'm saying I'm sorry for something, their eyes roll back in their head. They're like begging me, please, Mother, no more amends. You know, because what is it about? And again, it's the guilt of a parent, you know, that'll still come to me sometimes. You know, still, you know, episodes I had with them that were so unnecessary, you know, just because of my anger. You know, and that getting over that part of it. And again, the Al-Anon literature and the AA literature, you know, it's just like, let it be done. When does it get to be water over the dam? When I just let it go. And now I'm living that and doing the best that I can today to make that better. When it came to making amends to my husband, that's one of the hardest things I've ever done in my entire life. Absolutely, without a doubt. I do not say I'm sorry easily. And it's well known in my family that I don't. You know, every time I even do anything now, they all fend having a heart attack because it's how off seldom that they actually hear me say that I was wrong about something. And again, ego, all those kinds of things. How important is it to me to be right? It's hugely important to me to be right. Why? Because I was raised that way. You're right. And if you're not right, you make it right. You do it this way. I mean, this is just the Sarge always in my face. This is, you know, you make it happen. And this is also, and it's so, and if you're wrong, you're in trouble for being wrong. You're in big, big trouble for being wrong. I can't be wrong. Can't make a mistake. Going to be in big trouble for that. You know, even though now I'm an adult person, you think I would know better, but no, I don't, because I'm hardwired to think that way. And I remember the very first time that I made amends to my husband, and I didn't do it willingly. I made it because it was sponsored directed. And what happened was I had my sponsor, Jeannie, and Butch had gone to work one morning, and he had a dead battery, and he asked me to jump it, and I did, and then he ran out of gas. And this pissed him off because he's an alcoholic, and they react to that kind of stuff that way sometimes. You know how they are. And so he got mad, so I got mad at him, you know, and he stormed off to work, and I went upstairs, and I called my sponsor, and I reported his behavior, okay, because it was bad. And when I got done telling her what happened, she said to me, "When Butch gets home tonight, you owe him an amends. What you said was unkind and unnecessary." And, you know, and Jeannie was, she was from Holland, so, you know, she didn't know how we did things in America, which I think was a big problem all the time between her and I. And she had this thick Dutch accent, too. You could hardly understand a bloody word she said. But, boy, when she was my sponsor, I never missed a word. And I remember her saying, so, you know, and obviously I'm thinking, you know, she didn't hear me the first time through the story because she didn't hear who started it. I think that's important stuff. I don't know about you guys. So I don't tell her she's stupid. I start telling her the story a second time because obviously, you know, she didn't hear the details the first time through. And I barely get started telling her the story again when she tells me to shut up. You know, I heard you the first time. You know, and for don't start a story again, and don't ever call me, by the way, and start a conversation with Butch said or Butch did. I am not Butch's sponsor, I am Larcine's sponsor. And for what she said and did, she owes her husband an amends. Goodbye, I'll see you at the meeting tonight. Click, end of conversation, we are done. You know, I learned valuable lessons. Never call your sponsor first thing in the morning because you got all day long to think about what it was she told you to do, you know. And never call your sponsor that night if you're going to see her at a meeting because she's going to want to know if you followed direction. And I'm a rule and regulation person. I got no choice. You know, I'm going to do what she told me. And I certainly did. And I don't know what time, whenever Butch walked in the door that evening, I marched right up to him. And I said, "I'm sorry I let your shitty attitude affect me the way that it did. And I'll try and do better in the future." Now, that may not sound like the best amends that you've ever heard, but I'm here to tell you that it's the best amends that I think I've ever, ever made in my life, ever. And I say that to you because that day I was this much willing to take direction, to risk being wrong, to listen to someone who I knew in my sponsor had my best interest at heart, who wanted me to be happy, joyous, and free. And this was the way to go, even though every sense told me it's his fault, he started it, he did it. That's the old thinking. That's the old thinking that keeps us locked up in the misery and the jabizery day after day after day. So important to be right. You know, so important that because they're going to poke at you and laugh at you and do whatever. Now, I don't remember Butch's reaction to that. I don't remember if he was happy about it, if he feigned a heart attack about it. I'm sure he was shocked to even hear me say anything, that I was sorry for nothing. Because, see, up until that day, he was a built-in excuse for every bad thing I ever did. Having an alcoholic, boy, just lets you get away with murder pretty much most of the time. Because the things they always do wrong seem this big. And then the things I always did initially only seem this big. But it wasn't very long how I'm affected by the family disease of alcoholism that my wrongs got bigger than his. And my wrongs I know got bigger than his. Because all the stuff he did under the influence of alcohol or drugs. Every hurtful thing he did, every promise he broke. But the things I did stone cold sober just to hurt him. Just to hurt him. And I don't think I owe amends. I don't think I've done anything wrong. And again, the family disease of alcoholism, how that works. You know, and then in the big book, you know, again, and the Al-Anon literature, you know, doing those, you know, going through those things, jealousy, you know, with things that happen in our relationship through the drinking. you know, very painful, and I know lots of people have all kinds of different stories about that. You know, marriage is a sacred trust. You take vows, and you want to honor those, and you want to cherish those. And, you know, Butch and I got married because I ended up getting pregnant, and that's definitely the driving force behind us getting married. But I want you to know that Butch and I got married in a church that we were as sincere as any two people are when they get married, that we loved each other, that we wanted to take care of each other and cherish each other and honor all those vows. But what Butch didn't know and I didn't know was it wasn't just Butch and Larsine that got married that day. It was also the family disease of alcoholism. And I'm here to tell you the family disease of alcoholism doesn't love or cherish anything or anybody. It'll tear your family apart through the alcoholic or through the non-alcoholic. It's totally irrelevant to the family disease of alcoholism. And what I know that, you know, for Butch and I, for those things, the sexual things, the things that maybe happened outside of our marriage, what I know today about that is that that all happened in that sickness of the disease of alcoholism. You know, and though I never cheated on my husband with anybody, I used sex as a weapon, believe you me, at every possible turn. At every possible turn. But I don't see that way. You know, I'm able to see it now as I'm able to step away back from it. You know, and the things that have to go and why I have to make amends to my husband. Because I don't know if you know it, but alcoholics really do like sex. There's something they like it a lot. And boy, I find out what he likes a lot, and I do whatever I can to manipulate and do whatever. You know, and the same thing with jealousy and sobriety. You know, Butch is getting sober, and I go with him occasionally. I don't go with him much anymore after the first 6 months, but after that, I would go with him occasionally to AA meetings, and AA women would come up to me. Are you Butch's wife? Yes, I am. We just love him. We think he's so wonderful. You know, yeah. I bet you do. Chapter 5, How It Works. I get him sober and some AA broad steals him away from me. Yeah, I gotcha. Information from nowhere right here. And, no, I don't know. Women in AA don't want him anymore, you know, than whatever. But it's just, again, all of that. Because why? Because I'll tell you why. Because I watched my husband getting well in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it scared the crap out of me. Because, see, I'm always thinking, you know, I'm always the good guy in the situation. But when you really watch someone get well, it can be terrifying as the family member. It's very scary. You're going to lose your spot. It's like my friend Crazy Jean used to say to me, it's like they get sober and you're out of a job. You know, you're just like, what do I do now, you know? Because see, I don't got to be good. I don't have to have principles or anything else like that because I'm dealing with this all the time. I never have to look at myself when my focus is always over there 24/7. You know, and what I got to watch is I got to watch my husband getting well in Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank God that he practiced these principles in all of his affairs, and especially those of bringing his program home and working it in the house, despite my anger, despite my resistance to it. He kept doing it anyway, because that's the attraction that we talk about here. He didn't let my anger and my stuff push him away from that. He would just say crap to me all the time, which would drive me nuts. I'd be really angry about something, and he'd be, well, you should let go and let God. You know, I mean, I tell you, there's times in the kitchen I wanted to stab him with my wooden spoon right through that sober heart of his, I'll tell you. You know, because again, one more time, I don't want to look at my part in it. That's the sickness that afflicts all of us, the alcoholics and the non-alcoholics alike. You know, and the money thing as well. You know, Butch and I didn't come in with a lot of debt when he got sober. I'll tell you, we were 9 months behind in our rent. And we only got to live in that apartment because there was a kind person there who didn't want to put, you know, a family with two little kids out on the street. But I would tell you, I was all alone and no one ever supported me. No one ever helped me. And there were so many people along the line who were so kind to me over and over and over again. You know, but we were fortunate that we didn't have a lot of debt when, other than that 9 months, pretty much, because back then when my husband got sober too, they didn't hand out credit cards like freaking pretzels anymore. I mean, they didn't. You really had to establish credit to get credit. You know, they didn't give them to high school students or whatever, you know, so we didn't have all of that debt. But we had a lot of issues with money and not trusting each other with money. And when Butch got sober, and after he was sober for a while, he would ask me questions that I thought were none of his business. Like, how much money do we have? I know how much I have, you know. I know. You're lucky if I give you $5 a week to get by, you know, and stuff like that. And again, my fear, you know, that one more time if I trust him. And again, all the damage that comes with that. But my husband stayed the course, and he practiced the principles in all his affairs, and he didn't push me for it, you know, and stuff. But he still asserted his right to know certain things. And then I couldn't deny those things to him when he was proving himself a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, working the principles to the best of his ability. And when he kept pushing me that way, it had to push me that way as well. You know, because then it wasn't about him anymore. I couldn't look at him anymore. Why am I so anxious? Why am I so fearful? You know, and why I have to make the amends that I have to make. And just being able to see that in clarity. You know, so that I can have the shot at a good life. Because that's really what alcoholism robs me of over and over and over again. My fear, you know, robs me of the shot of having a good life. But when I just do what is indicated for me to do. You know, and the same thing with making amends to difficult people. You know, some people in my life that I had to put on that list are just, you know, my mom. She's a difficult person sometimes. She's very hard, and she flips all the time. She's the sweetest woman you ever want to know on one day, and the next day, God, I don't even know who this woman is. Making me still feel bad at 60 years old that I'm not the daughter that she thinks I should be or doing the things that I'm supposed to do. And then the next week, I'm like the best thing since sliced salami and how much she loves me and appreciates me. You know, and how do you go about dealing with that over and over and over again? You know, and what I've learned here, and again, in making amends, is what my sponsor told me is when I go to my mom, is that my only job is to be the daughter. I don't get to be the mother. I don't. So my job is to do what the daughter is supposed to do, not what the mother is supposed to do, nor am I to judge what the mother is supposed to do or what I think the mother is supposed to do in this situation, because I'm not the mother in this situation. And that has helped me more than I can even begin to tell you. When I just do my job in the relationship. Because I can get into that with Butch too. You know, because I know what the husband should do to please me. I got no trouble with that. We all know I could be a better husband than he is, okay? I mean, there's no question, you know, or whatever. But it's not my job. And how my sponsor explained that to me was real simple. Was, Larsine, do you want to be married to you? Stirred the crap out of me right there, you know, or something else. Because there is not room in our house for two of me. I know that for a fact. It would never, ever work. And in reality, I don't want to be married to me. I don't. I want to be married to someone who's easygoing, who takes life in stride, who enjoys, who sees the big picture all the time. Because my thing is always, I am focused. My big thing is on task. I am hardwired to think that way. You know, it's just like I always have this narrow vision, but then coming to you guys, and one more time, you let me appreciate my husband for what he can see, because I don't always see it that way. You know, I always liken it, like we go on these vacations, we go on these family vacations, I have these notoriously famous notebooks, because when we're going on vacation, especially like a 3-week motorhome vacation, I got a notebook with tabs. Everywhere we're going to go, what's there, where the gas stations are, where the campgrounds are, you know, the reservations, where the biggest ball of sticks is or whatever's going on, and we're going to see, and we're going to go on certain hikes, and when we start on a hike, by God, we finish a hike, because I got to finish stuff. I don't start nothing I don't ever finish. And we can go, it'd be a 10-mile hike, and then maybe 3 miles into this hike, we come across a lake. And Butch takes off his hiking boots and puts his feet in the lake. And he thinks we should spend the rest of the day there because it's really pretty. You know, and I am like, we are touching the wall, buddy. Get those shoes on until we get back and come back. You know, because I don't see what's going on there. And I remember one time we were on one of these hikes, And it was a very it was just an icky day. And we're coming back from it. And we've gone to this waterfall that had no waterfall, which is always pisses me off when I've gone that far. And there's just this wet spot, like looking at a toilet as far as I'm concerned. So we're coming back, and here's this guy, a scraggly dude, older guy, older gentleman with a stick, pissed off to beat the band, dusty all over, and how much further is it to the waterfall, you know? And I know how he feels, because it was a really hot day, and I go, you got about another mile and a half, and off the guy goes. And it wasn't too long after that we come across another guy, you know, about the same age, walking along smiling, and all he says to us is, beautiful day for a hike, isn't it? And that guy walks on by, and then Butch turns to me, and he goes, first guy destination-oriented, second guy journey-oriented, which guy do you want to be? And you know, and I know which guy I want to be. I think we all know sitting here which guy we want to be. But being able to do that day after day after day, because as Sheldon said, the voice in the head, that why this isn't. And maybe it's the struggle that's important. But what I do know for a fact is that, you know, when I'm able to make the amends when they are necessary, you know, to put the people on the list when they are necessary, that it just frees me to be me. That's all. And it doesn't let them have power over me anymore. You know, how do I make amends to a dead dad? You know, what I do is I think about him fondly. I think about the good things he taught me. Duty, honor, country. You know, he gave me a lot of good things. I have a very strong worth ethic because of my dad. I can make a bed tighter than anything you've ever been in your life because of my dad. And Butch has been stuck in it a couple of times, so he can tell you for a fact. You know, and the books and the steps show us how to be able to do that so that we can move on with our life, so that we can get the shot at a good life. And I want to read something that Lois Wilson had written on step 9, because I thought it was monumental to me. She says, specifically to step 9, this is just as important for me as the alcoholic, to have serenity, a joy in living and doing, to be able to withstand the hard knocks that come along the way, and it helps others to do the same. I have found I had to make specific amends for each harm I have done. I couldn't help others while emotionally sick myself. You know, so if you're an Al-Anon and you're thinking that you don't owe amends or it's not important for you to do it because the harm that's been done to you is so much greater, you know, I ask you to think again about how free do you want to be? How good of a life do you want to have? You know, because it's not about them. And I always thought it was. It's not at all about them. It's about me and my reaction to it. And there's also a page in the ODAT, and this is on November the 15th, that was instrumental in helping me with that too. It said, one way Al-Anon is a big help is that it reminds me of the truths I tend to forget. For example, I hear again and again at meetings and read in Al-Anon literature, alcoholism is a disease. The alcoholic is a sick human being. We do not punish people for being sick. I may give ample lip service to this idea, but when it comes to real acceptance, my instinctive attitude toward the alcoholic is often hostile, as though he were an enemy, willfully bent on destroying me. I need Al-Anon's constant reminders that such feelings hinder both my spiritual progress and improvement in the family situation. I must rid myself of the poison of resentment, indignation at a person I am not capable of judging fairly, and useless pity for myself. If I am suffering from bitterness against the alcoholic, I will cling to the thought that my growth and serenity depend on overcoming my animosity. Unless I free myself from it, I may carry it over into my relations with other people, even those who in Al-Anon are trying to help me. It is not men's acts which disturb us, but our reaction to them. Take these away and anger goes. No wrong act of another can bring shame on you. But what I do is I bring shame on myself when I don't practice this to the best of my ability, when I don't allow you to be you. I don't know how you're going to react to a situation, and who am I to judge that? Because I don't know what's happened to you before. If I'm thinking I'm doing the best that I can, then why don't I give you credit for thinking that you're doing the best that you can as well? And again, it frees us up. And the other thing of that, and I'm gonna close with this, is you know, in the big book, after you do 8 and 9, the promises are there. You know, and before we are halfway through, we will know a new freedom and a new happiness. And I absolutely, positively believe that. But I know that I know the steps from the Al-Anon perspective. And instead of reading those promises, I want to read what we call the Al-Anon promises. And they're in the book From Survival to Recovery, which I love this specific reading very, very much. Because it's about me as a family member, really important. It says, if we willingly surrender ourselves to the spiritual disciplines of the 12 steps, our lives will be transformed. We will become mature, responsible individuals with a great capacity for joy, fulfillment, and wonder. Though we may never be perfect, continual spiritual progress will reveal to us our enormous potential. We will discover that we are both worthy of love and loving. We will love others without losing ourselves, and we will learn to accept love in return. Our sight, once clouded and confused, will clear, and we will be able to perceive reality and recognize truth. Courage and fellowship will replace fear. We will be able to risk failure to develop new hidden talents. Our lives, no matter how battered and degraded, will yield hope to share with others. We will begin to feel and will come to know the vastness of our emotions, but we will not be slaves to them. Our secrets will no longer bind us in shame. As we gain the ability to forgive ourselves, our families, and the world, our choices will expand. With dignity, we will stand for ourselves, but not against our fellows. Serenity and peace will have meaning for us as we allow our lives and the lives of those we love to flow day by day with God's ease, balance, and grace. No longer terrified, we will discover we are free to delight in life's paradox, mystery, and awe. We will laugh more. Fear will be replaced by faith, and gratitude will come naturally as we realize that our higher power is doing for us what we cannot do for ourselves. Can we really grow to such proportions? Only if we accept life as a continuing process of maturation and evolution towards wholeness. Then suddenly we begin to notice these gifts appearing. We see them in those who walk beside us. Sometimes slowly or hauntingly, occasionally in great bursts of brilliance, those who work the steps change and grow toward light, toward health, toward their higher power. Watching others, we realize this is also possible for us. Will we ever arrive, feel joyful all the time, have no cruelty, tragedy, or injustice to face? Probably not. But we will acquire growing acceptance of our human fallibility, as well as greater love and tolerance for each other. Self-pity, resentment, martyrdom, rage, and depression will fade into memory. Community rather than loneliness will define our lives. We will know that we belong, we are welcome, we have something to contribute, and that is enough. Thank you for letting me share with you today.